The most dangerous place you can be as a trial lawyer is to think you've got it figured out.
I'm still trying to get better. I still have the passion for it. I believe in it.
Everyone can learn to do what I do.
And yet there's a group here that continues to get extraordinary verdicts.
Trial Lawyers University is revolutionizing educating lawyers to be better trial lawyers. It's been invaluable to me.
Trial Lawyers University, where the Titans come to train. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome, everybody, to the very first guest co-hosted version of the Trial Lawyers University podcast. I have the privilege of being the very first co-host here at the TLU Beach House in Hermosa Beach, just steps away from the Pacific Ocean. And speaking of ocean, we got the $30 million man, Evan O'Shan. How are you doing today, Evan?
Doing good. How are you?
All right. On a serious note, before we start, I want to give my condolences to your family, the beloved Blue Angie, the Frenchie in your family, the family dog passed recently. If you want to share with the audience a few words about Blue Angie.
Thank you. So Blue Angie was a very special dog. Everywhere he would go, he would touch people. In fact, I think he had something like a 500,000 followers on Facebook. I guess you could say Blue Angie got me my first high-profile case.
Tell us about that.
So it was around 2017, and there was a blast on national news. There was a dog that was put in an overhead bin of a United Airlines flight, and the dog died. And it was being covered by the Today Show, I think Good Morning America. I mean, it was national news. So my wife says, hey, you got to get on a plane. You got to go to New York right now. And I said, look, I'm not going to New York. I'm in the middle of a case. No, you got to get on a plane, go to New York. You got to help this family. She was on a discussion group with other Frenchie owners. So I did what you're supposed to do. I listened to my wife. I just got on a plane. And as I'm flying, I'm thinking, well, what's going on here? I really didn't know why I was on the plane. I just knew I had to go there and help this family out. So I get on the plane, and it becomes apparent to me that there was a gross injustice the way this dog was treated. He was put in an overhead bin. The family was essentially bullied. A little girl was bullied to put the dog in the overhead bin, and the dog died.
Which is ridiculous. It's ridiculous to put like electronics in there sometimes, let alone a living being.
Yeah, no. I mean, this was a living, breathing family member. So as I got more into it, other attorneys that I knew, I told them what I was doing. They said, there's no way. A dog is essentially a piece of luggage. I said, no, that's a family member. They need help. So I went there. And over the course of, it was several weeks, it might have been several months, I fought with United Airlines.
The referral source for this lead, speaking of the business of law, was Blue Angie, your dog.
It was Blue Angie, because I was going there to fight for one of his own.
And his referral fee was paid in dog treats?
It was paid in love, dog treats, and a pat on the head. He was a great dog.
So you actually, and you brought up a good point about a lot of lawyers, and unfortunately, like in America, the dog is so beloved. It's part of our families and everything like that. But we have a disconnect between what our real lives and then the law, because in many states, dogs are treated like they're worthless almost. You just get the economic value, and the dog is much more than that, obviously.
Right, and different states have different laws. I got to know this very well. I handled many dog cases. Actually, several of my cases, one in particular, was covered by Good Morning America. And I was able to shut down, essentially, a cargo facility at the airport in Detroit for a dog who also passed away on a flight. It became somewhat of a passion for me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's incredible, because growing up, from an Arab family, I wasn't exposed to dogs. And then later in life, after college, my friends had dogs, and there's nothing like the bond between a dog and his best friend. It's really a special bond. And they're part of the family, and sometimes even more than that, right? Because you're so close to them and all the memories. It's really tragic that they only live usually around 15 years. And so there's always going to be that built-in sort of, tragedy.
Yeah, Blue Angie was very special. He was actually born on my wife and I, our anniversary.
Oh.
And the dog passed yesterday, which was my mom's birthday.
Wow. Happy May birthday 23rd. To your mom.
Well, she passed.
Oh, she passed?
Yeah.
Oh,
so it would have been her birthday. So this dog was very connected to me, to my family, and all his followers. He had, like I said, about 500,000 followers that just loved him. During the pandemic, Blue Angie and I would do short videos eating.
Adorable.
So we would have similar outfits, and we'd eat. He used to eat with his paws. He'd eat pizza, popsicles, everything. They're still all over the internet.
Just not chocolate, right? For those that
don't
ever give a duck chocolate. That's not nice.
Yeah, no chocolate. But it was something to pass the time during COVID, and it made a lot of people happy.
Of course, yeah. There's nothing. Cat videos and dog videos are the, and for me, orca. I love orcas. I have this crazy obsession with killer whales. Whale killers, but yeah.
It was incredible. He was on the Ellen DeGeneres show. He was on
before CBS. Diddy. That was a pre-Diddy.
Yeah, right? Pre-Diddy. Okay. Diddy.
We just gotta legal disclaimers. We're lawyers, so we gotta have legal disclaimers.
Yeah, he was famous.
Yeah.
It was pretty amazing.
That's awesome.
So I mean, that was just a personal note.
Now, transitioning, you talked about your mom, and she plays, I mean, both your parents played a big role in the man that you are today. But your mom has a very special role in who you are in your career and your life. Tell me about your mom and about your upbringing.
So my mom was a woman of faith. She was a great lady. She was my backbone. She was the wind under my wings. I wasn't such a great student as a kid growing up. I was always the one that they would say, oh, you're so capable, you're just not applying yourself. I didn't read until I was in third grade, and even then I wasn't, you know, such a great reader. Later, and I mean much later, at the end of my college career, I discovered that I had dyslexia.
Wow.
So I suffered from a severe reading disability my whole life. I would learn with tapes. I would sit with professors. I would talk to them, and I would learn material that way.
And this was before the age, I don't want to date you, but before the age of easy iPhones and AI transcriptions and all that stuff.
Yeah. There was
a dictaphone.
I had a tape recorder.
There was
none of that then. And the thing about my mom is my mom always hung in there with me. You see, when I was born, I had jaundice. I was very ill. I had 4 complete blood transfusions.
Wow.
And it was really a miracle that I survived. And she hung in there with me. She felt I had a much higher purpose than just, you know, not being able to read.
So instead of babying you, she challenged you to reach your potential.
She would challenge me. She would encourage me. She actually brought me to my first trial. And it was when I was about 8 years old. And at that point, I was hooked. I wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted to fight for justice.
Wow. And you've kind of, you've already touched upon it. I don't think many lawyers in the country, I know one from Jerry Spence Method, which is another thing we have in common, Jerry Spence University.
Yep.
Inaugural class, GSM. So the inaugural class. And you've also went there.
Class I did.
Of 24?
25.
25,
yes.
Wow. Okay. He does animal rights stuff too, and he faces uphill battles because he's filing lawsuits on behalf of pit bulls, right? Which is, you know, hard client, just like you have in human beings, hard clients. They're a hard client, and he fights to prevent them from being put down. But other than that, I've never heard of a lawyer that is like an animal lawyer that like literally kind of represents the animal. So, but you've also had another career. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, I wouldn't really call myself an animal lawyer. I was kind of a lawyer for justice. People have given me a nickname. They call me the wolf because I go after something and I don't give up. And so it's kind of like a kin to me, you know, the dogs and me kind of, you know, we connect. As far as other types of law that I've done, I also was involved with deportation defense.
Okay.
Post September 11th, there were a lot of Arab men, particularly certain
guilty
age.
Arab men right here,
certain age that were forced to special register.
Yeah,
there was almost like a witch hunt going on.
Yeah.
Where people had to go in and register, and so I took it upon myself to advocate and represent individuals that were being wrongfully accused. There was one particular case I remember where there was an individual who was named Muhammad, but not you.
Okay.
He didn't just have one Muhammad name. He had maybe 10 or 20 different Muhammad aliases. And they brought in a special prosecutor to the court in Lancaster, and they said that he was somebody we were taking to Guantanamo Bay. They had a whole team of people coming in. And so I was asking for bond to have him released.
And that's basically, it's not an actual death sentence, but it's essentially you're going there to die.
It would have been bad. It did not look good with all the Muhammad aliases. And he also had somewhat of a criminal background. I went in and it turned out he wasn't a terrorist, but he was definitely a criminal. So I pled.
That's how my wife describes me. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. So, well, I pled with the judge and I said, Your Honor, you know, just because he's a criminal, you can't send him to Guantanamo Bay, you know, release him on bond, let him move forward with his deportation hearing, but please don't send him to Guantanamo. The judge agreed to release him on bond, and there he went.
That's insane. Yeah, because post 9/11, I had to register. I have a special number that I use for flights. If I don't input it when I'm booking a ticket, it creates a hassle both domestically and internationally. Because a lot of people don't know this. I didn't know this. I got thrown off a flight one time in Delta Airlines. And my friend worked for the Obama State Department. He told me that it's a private third-party private security company that kind of processes those. And if you don't have the special number, that I had to go to the special registration process, separate from Global Entry and TSA PreCheck, I also have that, you get stuck. And I've personally experienced that. I've gotten thrown off a plane. And I'm a pretty thick-skinned guy, but it is one of the most humiliating things that ever happened. Like the plane is delayed. They come on the plane and they say, you got to come off the plane. And everybody looks at you like a terrorist or a criminal, which, you know, which nobody wants to be seen as that. There's other stuff that I do that is bad, but not that stuff. So I've personally gone through that, not to the level of Guantanamo or anything like that, but I've had friends that have been on the no-fly list. It's a tragedy.
Sure.
Yeah.
I also...
How did you get into that?
A friend of mine took me to a deportation defense hearing, and he got this guy off, and he reunited a family, an immigrant family. And so I was so taken in by it. His name is Edwin Amufwa. He's an attorney. He's actually from Nigeria. And he took me to my first deportation hearing. And so from there, I wanted to fight for justice.
Yeah. So, Evan, you have had a wild career. Tell us about your first start in personal injury.
So I was in law school. And my first year of law school at Hastings, my appendix ruptured. And I got very sick. So I missed the majority of my first year of law school. My dad, who was, you know, pretty hardworking guy, he was a barber. He said, "You got to go back. You got to take your exams." And I said, "Dad, I haven't been in school all year." He said, "No, go back, take your tests." So I went back and I failed. I failed civil procedure of all things.
Oh wow! Which is the most important thing for young lawyers, I think, to learn.
Which is very important, especially for trial attorneys.
Yeah.
So I fail civil procedure, and I'm called before a committee, the Academic Disqualification Committee. I didn't know what that was. I just thought, hey, I'll go in. I'll tell them, look, I was sick my first year of law school.
But my dad is a hard-nosed depression-era guy.
Yeah, he was a hard-nosed depression-era guy. I said, you know, hey, just let me back in. I didn't think it would be a problem. Well, it was a problem. They said, no, you're done. And that was it. So I was out of law school.
They kicked you out of law school.
I was academically disqualified for one fail.
Wow.
And that was it.
After a ruptured appendix.
After a ruptured appendix, but I did go back and I took my tests. The school and I didn't exactly get along real well because I got very politically involved. My first year, I was a very strong advocate of disability rights. I formed a group in law school. My mom had lost her vision. My dad was deaf most of his life. Due to losing his hearing in World War II.
So they wanted to get rid of the headache that was Evan Ocean.
Yeah, I was definitely a headache. I had threatened them with a class action lawsuit.
Oh, God, as a first year law student. Context.
So they were, you know, they were happy that I failed that class, I think. I mean, I don't know. I mean,
it gave them the excuse to bring the hammer down. Like we see in many of our cases.
And they did. They brought the hammer down. But the dean was very nice. He wrote me a letter and he said, look, he's a fine young man. He just failed this class. And there's nothing ethically wrong with him, but he can't go back to this school.
So since then, you've been doing unauthorized practice of law.
Well, no. Okay. So my dad, I went back to my dad, and my mom and my dad went to meet with the dean, and the dean gave my mom a letter, which basically said, look, I'm ethically able to practice law. I was just failing the one class, went into all the detail. And I took that letter, and I was like, now what do I do with the letter? My dad said, well, go to the governor. So I did. I went to the governor, and ultimately the governor intervened, and I wrote somewhat of a brief, gave it to the governor's special attaché.
Wow.
They gave it to the law school, and I had my second chance. I came back to law school the next year.
So your mom was instrumental in you not giving up about your capacity.
Yeah.
As a kid, and then your dad literally saved your law career.
My dad did, more than one way. He was always there for me to fall back on. Wow. He encouraged me.
And I'm sure his work ethic, he was a barber in Detroit, just across the river from Al Capone in Chicago.
Right? Yeah, that was in the 40s, but then he moved to California and he kind of left that lifestyle behind. He became a barber in California. And so during that, there was a whole year I was fighting with the law school. So I had the governor's office on my side. I was fighting with the law school to get back in. It was at that time I got a job working as a paralegal for a very prominent personal injury law firm, Grissini and Wrinkle.
Okay.
Larry Grissini and Roland Wrinkle are probably two of the finest personal injury attorneys in the history of this country. I mean,
are they still practicing?
They're not. They're not practicing, but they are very, very well respected. They're very well known. And it was there that I experienced what a real top-notch quality personal injury attorney can
do. So you fell into like a great scenario.
I did.
So, and it goes to show, like, look, doesn't matter what you're dealing with in the now, it's probably going to have a good impact down the road.
Yeah, and I did, but then that got put on hold. I went back to law school. I lost my job because I wasn't a paralegal anymore. Graduated from law school, and then I struggled with taking the bar. Took me a little bit of time, but I passed it. I passed it the first time in Washington. One of the reasons I went to Washington is because there was no multiple choice test there, and I had difficulty with multiple choice tests.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Passed on my first shot up there.
Nice.
August 24th through 28th, Satch Oliver has come all the way from Arkansas to right here to Hermosa Beach to TLU Beach House. And we're going to be teaching a 5-day Depositions Are Trial boot camp. You're going to be working on your cases. Satch is going to be working with you on your cases. So not only are you going to transform your case, but at the end of the day, it becomes a case expense because your case is going to get that much better. This program is limited to 10 participants. So if you want to come, get registered today. We'll see you right here.
Speaking of Washington, Seattle, Washington, this is where your big $30 million verdict was. Tell us about that case, wild case.
So it was, I guess it was 2021. It was post-George Floyd. If you remember during George Floyd, the streets had erupted.
Yeah.
COVID was still going on. People were wearing masks. Things were out of control.
I remember seeing tanks in Santa Monica, and they literally like imported police divisions from other cities.
Yeah, it was
something I've never seen before.
It was completely out of control, and their race relations were at an all time high. Except for when I was a kid, I remember when I was bused, just regressing to the inner city, and students were bused to my school.
It was like a two-way exchange.
Right, and so there was integration. That was a very important part of my life growing up, was during the forced busing era. That was when I first experienced what racial profiling was. I was a white kid, primarily coming from a white area, going to school with primarily African-Americans. And these students from the inner city were welcome into my home. My parents welcomed them in, and
that's awesome.
We would, we'd hang out together. But I saw what racial profiling was.
And you grew up Jewish, and so that Jews played a pivotal role in the civil rights movement. So that's kind of just natural sort of thing for your parents.
I
always going for the underdog.
I think so. I think that was a big part of it. But ironically, that was probably a big part of why I was drawn to help the Muslims who were being, what I thought was being discriminated against during the post 9/11 era.
Yeah.
So sure, that had a lot to do.
Your parents had a, I mean, you know, I had great parents growing up. It's the biggest blessing in the world, I think. And I can see that from your parents, the impact they had on you. It impacted who you are every day, not just your career, but it spills over, obviously.
Yeah, they taught me from a young age, you don't judge somebody by the basis of their skin or their religion or what they look like.
Which is very lazy, but we like to be lazy. I mean, human instinct is to be lazy, rely on propaganda and whatnot. It's very, that's incredible that you, yeah, that your parents did that, especially in a time when it wasn't popular to do. You grew up in L.A. in the, around what year?
It was in the 70s when the busing was going on.
Yeah.
And there were actually race riots in my junior high. I got maced a few times. I witnessed some horrible violence. I saw one of my friends have his ear sliced off with an umbrella point. Another friend had his jaw broken right in front of me.
Wow.
I was oftentimes in fights.
So that was the 70s, and then we had the crazy Rodney King things in the 90s. You're one of the few people that's actually from L.A. Like, I live in L.A. I've been here for, you know, over 20 years, but I grew up in the desert 2 hours away from here. So it's rare to meet an L.A. person.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm from L.A., but I'm also from Seattle now, and also from New York, because my practice has taken me to New York as well. So I've been blessed that people have trusted me with their case.
With all kinds of different cases and all kinds of different places.
All kinds of different cases. Yeah. And that experience I had with Grassini and Wrinkle instilled the fight for the personal injury underdog.
That's
brain
awesome.
Injured, sexual discrimination, all different types of cases.
Basically the most malign kind of cases, and, you know, especially before the Me Too movement, sexual assault cases were like anathema. And so the George Floyd, post George Floyd. So how does a post George Floyd case end up in Seattle with the wrongful death?
George Floyd, the streets had erupted in violence, really true violence, racial violence. The Black Lives Matter movement takes off in Seattle. Okay. So a young man, Antonio Mays Jr., idealistic young man, goes to Seattle because he wants to participate in the movement.
And where's he from, Antonio Mays?
He's from Southern California.
Okay.
So he comes up to Seattle to peacefully protest. Okay. And I know this was the case. I spent a lot of time with his father. There was actually one video that had surfaced that you could probably still pull offline where he's actually peacefully protesting. He's speaking up.
And they had no credible allegations or anything like that he did anything other than that.
No, he didn't do anything.
Yeah.
Right.
Not even charged or perceived to be charged of a crime.
Well, no. But the city of Seattle, and I'm not saying the police, the city of Seattle attempted to
make that innuendo,
create a narrative.
Yeah.
Which was ultimately dismissed by the judge and directed verdict that he had been committing a felony. And so because of committing the felony, he should be barred from any recovery. Now, he meaning his estate, he wasn't here.
Yeah. And he's passed, Antonio Mays Jr. And the committing a felony was a technicality, right? Because they said just being in that area was an unlawful assembly or some technicality like that.
No, it was even a little more than that. There was somebody who had come forward that said that he was assaulted with brass knuckles, many, many things. There was a box of evidence that was brought out. Later on, it was clearly established that this wasn't connected to my client, but it was pretty intense.
And they were just trying to throw anything out the wall to stick to kind of excuse themselves from their conduct.
You know, I'm not going to accuse them of doing something that would be improper, but they weren't able to establish any of it.
Or even come close. I mean, directed verdict, for those that don't know, it's basically the judge saying, no jury, no reasonable jury on earth. It's like the judge can step in. The jury's only there to decide factual questions that are confusing or that can go both ways, so to speak, theoretically, even if it's the evidence is overwhelming. The judge is like, no, this is nonsense, and he threw it out.
Right. And this case, when it was first filed, it was filed against the former mayor of Seattle, police chief, fire marshal, head of city council, It was a lot of individuals that were named in the city of Seattle. That was removed at summary judgment, and the only thing I was left with was the city of Seattle.
Okay.
A big part of the case that we won was getting past governmental immunity, which was a big deal. And we were able to establish that the paramedics delayed the treatment of Antonio Mays Jr. The system failed him and essentially led to his damages, his death.
So Antonio Mays, taking a step back, Antonio Mays is protesting, peacefully protesting. What happens to him?
So he's peacefully protesting, and violence erupts in the CHOP zone. The CHOP zone was an area that was designated by the city as a peaceful protest zone, a protest zone. But it was not a safe zone. People believed it was safe because, you know, the mayor, for instance, went on to CNN and said it was a summer of love. It appeared to be a safe place for a lot
of people. They advertised it as such.
Promoted it as such, but the reality was it was a very dangerous place. Police were not let in. Fire department personnel were not allowed in.
Wow.
So when Antonio Mays Jr. was shot and dying in the CHOP zone, the police couldn't get in. Paramedics couldn't get in.
And nobody knows who shot him.
To this day, we still don't know who shot him.
Wow.
And so we didn't have a shooter.
And so if they couldn't get in, I imagine their argument was, well, we couldn't get in, so he just died. We couldn't do anything about it, right?
Well, so the Good Samaritans, there was Good Samaritans, they put him in the car, called 911, and attempted to get him to the paramedics. And at one point, the paramedics ran away from the vehicle that was pursuing him. And there was a delay in his treatment, and he died. It was pretty horrible.
So they're coordinating with 911 in a sort of way, and the ambulance ran away, and that's what the jury found. The ambulance ran away, and dereliction of their duty.
There was a delay. We shot 8 times. I mean, wow. We shot once in the head, once in the jaw. So it was a pretty severe shot. And so a big part of the case was causation. Would he have survived?
Yeah. And so you get shot 8 times, once in the head, you're not 50 Cent, so you don't survive. And they're like, well, he would have died anyways. Even if we did everything right, he would have died anyway. So you're dealing with an impossible case against an impossible defendant with governmental immunities, which basically, for those that don't know, protects them in a way that doesn't protect private citizens. God forbid if I ever did something heinous like that, there'd be nothing to protect me from the law, money justice or criminal justice. But cops and police, they can get away with it. Not disparaging them, but they have immunities that a higher hurdle. And then you also had a tough venue or a tough judge?
Well, I have a lot of respect for the judge that handled the case. Initially, I had some concerns because we were initially going after the mayor, the police chief, fire marshal, many individuals.
Politically charged case.
Very politically charged. I believe that the judge was brave to allow the case to move forward. It cleaned up the case. It focused the case. In the end, I feel the judge was making solid decisions, but it was difficult. Very politically charged case.
And it's interesting you say that, because a lot of times as lawyers, especially ones that are in a charged case, this is a very emotional case, we kind of over allege and over include defendants, and we get all worked up when the judge might rule one way or the other. And in the end, it helps us because it cleans up the case. They're maybe not trying to do us a favor. They're just trying to follow the law. But sometimes it actually works in our favor in kind of mysterious ways that we don't always understand in hindsight.
Yeah, I think the judge has a very tough job. I mean, he has to be fair on both sides. And I think in the end, the judge did us a favor, did everybody a favor, the plaintiff, the defense, cleaned up the case, focused the case, took it out of politics, took it into the courtroom where it needed to be. There was another thing that happened in the case. We didn't have a shooter. There was a special instruction that came out that the recovery needed to be limited if you don't have the shooter. I asked for $100 million. I got $30.5
million. Okay.
So it all worked out.
Yeah. So, you know, that 69.5, you know, is floating out there somewhere. So how did you break down that verdict? Because verdicts are broken down into, like, what Nick Rowley likes to say, checkbook, damages, which is, you know, expenses, medical bills, funeral expenses, because it's a wrongful death, versus money damages, which is pain, suffering, emotional distress, all of the things that when we lose them in our own life, they're infinitely valuable, but we kind of, as jurors, we might struggle to assign a value to them. So break down the verdict. How was it broken down between checkbook or pocketbook damages versus the real damages?
Sure. So I'll break it down simply. I'll just round it up. So about $6 million was for the estate.
Okay.
And for that, you could probably attach economic damages, you know, what Antonio Mays Jr. would have earned through the course of his life.
What's his payroll, salary, life earned?
That was like the hard numbers, right? $24 million was for non-economic damages, which is a reasonably large number with no medical bills supporting it, with no real bills, so to speak. It was just the truth of what my client suffered.
And your client, who did you actually represent?
I represented the estate of Antonio Mays Jr., and I represented the father, Antonio Mays Sr.
And the state is kind of like the economic entity, right? Basically, like if Antonio Mays Jr. lived out his whole life, how much money would he earn? What he had to pay out for the ambulance, right? Or whatever was done. And then the family is sort of the loss of that relationship.
Yeah,
and that human connection.
Well, the father had his own individual claim.
Yeah,
and I just asked for a round number. I just asked for a round number.
What do you feel was the most important thing you did in working with the father to learn that this was a valuable life, valuable relationship?
I had to believe, and I had to connect with the father. His fight needed to be my fight. I wasn't acting. I had to put myself in his position, and that's hard to do.
And some call that the golden rule or whatnot, but it's a good rule to live by. Jurors can't consider it, but as lawyers, it's almost a must to consider it, right? To, as they say, reverse roles and put ourselves in the shoes of the client.
Yeah, for me, it was essential. I don't know how I could have asked for that number without feeling it.
And what's one story, you know, to honor Antonio Mays Jr. And the bond that he had with his father, what's one story that stood out to you?
Well, the father and the son had a barbecue business. They would prepare barbecue.
Wow.
And they had a barbecue sauce line. And I remember going to see the father at the barbecue stand. His son wasn't there, and I could feel the emptiness.
See, what bothers me most about this and about the city of Seattle is the failure to accept responsibility. If the city creates a system, they're responsible when it fails. It's offensive what went on here for the last month. You heard a lot of lies here. I think we know where they're coming from.
I was able to take that and show that to the jury.
Wow. You worked with your father growing up sometimes? With the fruit stand or?
Well, I had my own fruit business.
Okay.
So we had a lot of trees in my property. We had like a small family orchard. So I would pick the fruit off the trees and then I would sell it to different health food stores. So I had business as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah, my dad, to this day, he still has a store inside of Indoor Swami, Coachella Indoor Swami, right next to the music festival. As a kid, you kind of begrudgingly go to work and whatnot, but you don't realize those moments are going to be the things you cherish the most. And for the father, it's even, I can't imagine doing that with my son and losing my son.
It was a part of him that was lost and can never be replaced. It was intense.
I saw a video of Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's longtime business partner, passed recently. And at the most, right after that, Charlie was at Warren Buffett was at a conference, and he gave his update. And he goes, "Charlie," and Charlie wasn't there. So I can imagine probably the dad, Antonio Senior, has probably had those moments where he says, "Oh, son, just you know," and he turns, and Antonio Junior is not there, because in a barbecue business, it's like father son. You're probably talking constantly, every minute, you're probably exchanging food, exchanging everything, and the banter. He probably has those moments where he turns and his son's not there anymore.
He does, and he also has a sauce line that he put together with his son. So, an empty space in his life forever.
Wow.
TLU On Demand is the library for trial. You catch everything you missed over the last 6 years, and we've collected all the pleadings, transcripts, and PowerPoints for all these cases and presentations from Las Vegas, New York, and from right here at the Paseo. And it's an app for your phone, and there's a Dan GPT feature on the desktop so you can search the entire database for exactly what you're looking for when you need it. If you're not a subscriber, you can call me on my cell phone or text me, 248-808-3130, and I will send you a 30-day comp code so you can try it at no risk. And then, finally, you will see what you've been missing out on for all these years.
We're going to be talking about this case and other cases at TLU Beach.
Yes.
TLU Beach is coming up June 3rd through 6th. On that note, I have one guest pass with your name on it. If you deserve it, you got to earn it. In order to earn it, you got to send me an email. If you're watching this before June 3rd, send me an email to ma@cromartylop.com. We'll put it up. Explain why you deserve this over the others that are going to be asking for it. And I can only give it to one person. So you get a guest pass as a guest co-host. I would not be a good guest if I wasn't a good host. So I got to host one guest, one lucky listener. And you'll get to see Evan Oshan speak with Chris Hammonds about what?
How to get massive verdicts with non-economic damages, 7- and 8-figure verdicts. I have another case coming up in New York.
And Chris got a 9-figure verdict.
Seven, eight, nine-figure verdicts. I have a big case coming up in New York. It's involving a fire that took place in 2017 in Harlem, involved the death of 6 individuals. It's been pretty heavily publicized, and that case is in the works right now.
And who's that case against? You probably stopped suing government entities after dealing with this.
No. Right? This is against the New York City Housing Authority.
Oh, wow. Okay, so, and they've been in the news recently because of Mayor Mamdani. Shout out to Mayor Mamdani.
Yeah, they're doing all kinds of bad things. They've been doing it for years, and we'll be uncovering lots of that.
From the past administrations.
I don't look at past, present, or future. I just look at what injustice. Yeah. So I really don't care about administrations. I care about the injustice. And there's a tremendous amount of injustice that goes on in the tenements of New York. A tremendous amount of injustice.
And so you don't care about the administrators. You care about the administration and how it's administered.
Yeah, so I try to stay out of politics.
That's the best.
I just focus on justice. I also don't really focus on the money. What I can tell you is this. I'm essentially a sole practitioner. I don't have a big firm backing me up. I don't have a bunch of paralegals. I've had it before. It doesn't work for me.
But you did have an Ivy League degree with straight-A student growing up. And never had any challenges in school, right? So on a serious note, tell me about that, because I know people that struggle in school, struggle with, you know, either dyslexia or just, you know, the LSAT, what all aspects of law. It's stress at every level. You've dealt with kind of all of it. You got kicked out of law school, struggle with the bar exam, struggle with reading. What's your message to the person out there that says, like, hey, I'm not, you know, I struggled. I don't have big resources behind me. I'm a solo or small law firm. What's your message to those people?
My message is that you just have to be willing to fight, and you have to be willing to take on a just cause. If it's a just cause, the money doesn't matter. The case doesn't matter. I've done a large number of Boy Scout sexual abuse cases over the years. These are people who have really not had their voice heard. I took them on because I care. That's what I do. I'm justice driven. I'm not money driven. I mean, the money's great, but that's not what drives me.
Yeah. And I think when you kind of put that one first, you know, obviously we get, you know, all we can get is money justice. As Nick Rowley says, we can't eye for an eye. It's just money justice. But when you put justice first, the money comes, in my experience. And Nick Riley actually talked about that when he was up and coming as a lawyer. He said, I'd try any case so long as there was a just cause. That was his prerequisite. It doesn't matter what the amount was or whatnot. That's why it was so appealing to people, because they're like, oh, you'll take this case? Nobody wants this case. Like, I'm sure many people probably turned down the Antonio Mays Jr. case.
Yeah, and in fact, I would say everybody did, pretty much.
Their loss.
Well, people were scared, yeah. Understandably so. I was threatened. My family was threatened.
Wow.
My career was threatened. To this day, I still have threats. I really don't care.
Yeah. And people will be able to talk to you at TLU Beach. If somebody wants to reach out to you, contact you, both before the conference or after the conference, how do they get in touch with you?
Sure. So you can reach out to me directly. You can contact me on my cell phone, 206-946-2706. You can text me at that number. You can also contact me through my website. I have a new website that's going to be launching. It's called Trial by Wolf. So trialbywolf.com or Oshan and Associates. You can look me up. But I'm here. I'm more than willing to help and encourage anybody who's got a just cause. That's what we do.
And if you're a dog watching out there, he pays dog bite referral fees, well, or dog snacks. Referral fees to dog.
Does this, but I'll tell you what I will do is I'm going to match your offer out there. So I'm going to match your offer. If anybody who hasn't registered yet, I do have one VIP pass, and I will give it out to whoever's out there that feels that they have a just cause and they have a reason to come to TLU. So tell me your just cause. Tell me why you feel you should come. I only have one, but I'm willing to give it out. Nice. If you have that just cause.
And it's a VIP. Mine is just a regular pass.
It's a VIP.
We're not bougie over here in Santa Monica.
It's a VIP pass.
All right. And then 206, is that Washington?
206 is Washington. Okay. I do also have a New York number, 646-421-4062. Okay. Feel free to contact me anytime. Text me, call me, send me an email. I'm here to help.
Evan, it was an honor, honestly, sincerely, learning about your parents, learning about your dog. Rest in peace, Frenchie, and rest in peace to both your parents. Or is your dad?
They both passed.
Yeah, rest in peace to both of them. And learning about your eclectic practice, that's inspiring.
Yeah. I do want to say one thing. I want to thank my wife, who's been very instrumental in my career, encouraging me. She backed me up in the Mays case.
She was out there in Seattle with you?
She was there. She was my paralegal. She was backing me up. She backs me up all the time.
And she her main role there probably is trying to keep all the women away.
No. She's very solid backup. She's very smart, very
qualified. So your nickname is not Evan, the ladies' man, Oshan?
No. My nickname is Evan the Wolf.
The Wolf.
The Wolf.
Nice. The Wolf. Like Hamza Chimaev, MMA. All right.
Evan the Wolf.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
All right.
And TLU Beach, do not miss it.